looks good morning and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, February 13th, 2011. My name is James Marino, and on the call this morning we have Michael Portantier, Matthew Murray, and Peter Felicia. Peter can be found three times a week at theatermania.com, also writes for Masterwork Broadway on Tuesdays. Is that Peter?
Yep.
Writes for the New York Star Ledger. Good morning, Peter.
Hi.
Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael can be found at npr.org. Also, you can see his photography at followspotphoto.com and also writes for Broadway Stars. Good morning, Michael.
Hi, James.
Also with us is Matthew Murray. Matthew is the chief theater critic for talkinbroadway.com and also writes for Broadway Stars. Good morning, Matthew.
Hi, James.
All righty. So, the three of you had the opportunity to see Black Tie. Matthew, why don't you give us an intro to that and let us know what you thought.
Well, Black Tie is the latest play by A.R. Gurney that deals with Northeastern wasps and their wacky adventures. And what made this one interesting for me is that it really sort of deals very directly with the death of that culture, or really the death of civilized or refined culture in general. It's about a man named Curtis, who is something of a high deal businessman. He's played by Greg Edelman, and he has gone to a resort in the Adirondacks to see his son get married to a young girl. His son's in his early 20s, and his wife is there. It's played by Carolyn McCormick, and their other daughter is there, named Elsie and played by Elvie Yost. There's one other person there too, and that's Curtis's father. But the really interesting part about that is that Curtis's father is technically dead, although you couldn't tell from the way Daniel Davis plays him in the show. He's very full of life and very funny and very entertaining, and certainly one of the most lively dead people I've seen on stage in a long time. But anyway, Curtis is scheduled to give a toast or a speech at the rehearsal dinner that night and isn't sure how to go about it. He wants to wear his father's tuxedo and kind of live up to the tradition that his father set when he gave a speech at Curtis's rehearsal dinner, or as his father would insist it be called, a bridal dinner, because his father was very, very persistent and very insistent that everything be called by their proper traditional names. And that is something that the younger generation is getting away from. And this new wedding is anything but traditional, and it is causing kind of a lot of rifts within the family. For instance, the woman that the son, Teddy, is marrying is part Peruvian, part African-American, and part Croatian. And the grandfather obviously has a little bit of a problem assimilating that, because it's so unlike anything that he is familiar with. And they spend a lot of time getting the placements of the tables and who's going to sit where at the rehearsal dinner just right. And then the bride's girlfriends go in there and tear it all apart and move everyone around. And they also had a very specific notion about people who get up and make speeches and all that. But the bride's ex-boyfriend, who's now a big-time comic, has decided to come by to sort of give the bride a quote-unquote going-away present, and he's doing this act that the New York Times is coming to see, and it's throwing everything into disarray. So the play's really, on one level, about the way Curtis and the family deal with all these changes that are happening to the rehearsal dinner and the wedding at the last minute. But it's really about something deeper, and I think much more interesting, in that it has a lot to do with how this very specific culture of people deals with really sweeping changes in the way the world that they were brought up in is vanishing before their eyes. Now, the thing that I said in my review about this that I want to say again here is that this is a comedy, but I didn't find it particularly funny. And I don't mean that as a criticism, because the dialogue is very entertaining. The production is very well directed by Mark Lamos, and the performances for the most part are fine. I thought Daniel Davis was far and away the best, and I loved Carolyn McCormick. I'm always amazed by how good she is, because I never think of her as kind of a first-tier sort of star, but she's terrific in this. And Greg Edelman carries the show very well. I think he's maybe a little bit too everyman for this kind of an elevated society type of role. But, you know, whatever. It was pretty well done from that standpoint. But I didn't really think it was very funny, because I see the situation as being very sad, because I think that the father, who has traditions and things that are very important to pass along that really could make the world a better place, and that would certainly make this wedding flow more smoothly in some ways. Yeah, it would sort of mean that the younger people wouldn't necessarily be able to do whatever they wanted with it, but that sometimes, you know, maybe that's okay. And so I actually thought it was really kind of sad to see this refined and really well-dressed and well-behaved world sort of go away before these characters' eyes. But A.R. Gurney does make he and Curtis's father, for that matter, eventually come to the conclusion that maybe not all of this kind of change is bad. They sort of leave the door open as to whether or not everything that's happening is good, and I obviously didn't think so. But they also don't completely say that everything that's going on here is necessarily for the worst. So it's really a well-balanced play. As I said, it's very entertaining. I didn't laugh much, but that's not because of any flaws in the writing. That's because of the way I was experiencing the play. The rest of the audience around me seemed to be enjoying it a great deal and laughing a lot, and I could totally understand that reaction. Michael and I attended the same performance, and I heard him laughing quite a bit, and I'm sure he will tell you more about that in a minute. But it's a very well done production of a very short play, you know, 90 minutes, very simple, very straightforward. John Ornone did a wonderful sort of backwoods institutional kind of hotel set that looks wonderfully cheesy and also a little bit nice, you know, upscale cheese, I guess, brie perhaps. But it's a really entertaining and a moving little play. It's not a lot of big sweeping thoughts that are really going to change your life, but it's very well executed for what it is, and I would certainly recommend checking it out if you get a chance. So Michael and Peter, I know you guys saw it too. What did you both think of it?
Well, I really enjoyed it. I guess maybe you could think of it as the Wasp version of Fiddler on the Roof. I never really thought of it that way before, but the way you were talking about the traditions and things changing, maybe that's what it is. I always enjoy Gurney's plays for the dialogue primarily. I think he does write wonderful dialogue. And for me, the revelation in this show was Greg Edelman, because I don't think I've ever seen him do a role before that required that kind of comedy. And I thought he was great in it, just really very natural and very funny. I agree with Matthew. It's certainly not a Neil Simon kind of guffaw every other minute comedy. It's more of a gentle comedy in this play, but really just very nice and lovely. And Daniel Davis did give a wonderful performance, and Ari Brand was terrific as the son. I really enjoyed it.
What's so interesting to me, I realized that this is the 24th Gurney play I have seen, dating back to the mid 70s when I saw his first produced play at Boston University called Scenes from American Life. Little did I know then, even though I liked it, little did I know that he was going to go on to such a spectacular career. And what's also so spectacular, he was not a young man then when he started. He had been a professor at MIT and certainly suddenly started writing up a storm. So to have seen 24 plays, for me, that's only eclipsed by Shakespeare, Neil Simon, and Tennessee Williams, who got much earlier starts than he did. The reason I mention these statistics has a lot to do with the fact that I felt this play was astonishingly similar to the other ones. I don't think that there was anything new in what he was doing here. However, what I would say is if you haven't seen many Gurney plays, this is one that you should see because it is typical of what he does. Yes, dealing with the Wasp culture. He is the official poster boy for that. And it's everything that these two gentlemen we just heard said. The idea that change is good or change is bad, the assets and the liabilities of change, to me also carried with it a theatrical metaphor that we've seen a lot of change, both good and bad, in the Broadway theater over the years. So that certainly occurred to me while it was happening. The thing about the set, that fascinated me tremendously because I knew that this was a Gurney play. I knew this was going to be about wasps. And when the lights came up, there we were in this rustic hotel room, paneling rather than flecked wallpaper. And suddenly, both Greg Edelman and Daniel Davis looked tremendously out of place immediately to me, which immediately said to me, something's off here. Why are they in this room? And they're in this room because, indeed, Greg Edelman's kid is getting married, and this is where the kid chose that they would get married. And it immediately, the juxtaposition of these two elements was fascinating to me, that I could tell at a glance that something was different, something was out of kilter. And I like that very, very much. So, yes, it's a worthwhile afternoon or evening. But I do feel that if other people have seen 24 Gurney plays, that they're going to find that this one is similar in stripe to the others. And under those circumstances, let's say missable.
Michael, you had mentioned Greg Edelman. Wasn't Greg Edelman in City of Angels?
Sure.
Did you consider that kind of a comedy? Did you see him in that, Michael?
Oh, yeah, but I don't know. My memory is that he was more of a straight man.
Yeah, James. Stein in City of Angels was much more of a serious character.
Yeah, you know, I never got the Stein and Stone things. I always juxtapose them. You know, it's kind of like Daisy and Violet and Sideshow, you know.
Actually, I will say one of the first things I ever saw Greg Edelman in was a wonderful production of She Loves Me that was done at, Peter, you're going to have to help me out for the title of the group. It was Jonathan Tunick's group.
I don't know about this.
It was called something like Opera Ensemble or something. And they did a few shows with Jonathan Tunick conducting full orchestras.
Wonderful.
The other one they did was Night Music that I saw. But they did a She Loves Me, and I can't offhand remember who else was in it. But Greg played George, and he was so wonderful and endearing in the title song. I'll never, ever forget it.
Nice.
After that, it seemed to me that, yeah, he mostly was cast as straight man. I mean, Wonderful Town, there's not a lot of comedy in that role. Mm-hmm. You know, and then sometimes, you know, he's also done some pretty heavy dramatic roles like 1776, Rutledge. But yeah, I just think he turns out to be a really wonderful light comedian, and I hope he does more of that.
Okay, so next up we have The Whipping Man. Peter, why don't you just give us a start here?
Well, actually, this is not the first time I've seen this play. This is a play that started in New Jersey at Luna Stage, which was then located in Montclair. The company has since relocated to West Orange, New Jersey. And I had the same feelings then that I did now. The production, by the way, in New Jersey starred Frankie Faison, because his wife, Jane Mandel, in fact, runs Luna Stage. So so he played the very important role of Simon. Simon is a newly freed slave. The Civil War has ended, and now he is still in the same house where he had been a slave. One of his masters has come home tremendously injured with gangrene on his leg, and it looks as if the leg is going to have to be amputated. But what's interesting is that the master, whose name is Caleb, is still ordering him around. And as he says, you can't order me anymore. You must ask me to do things. So we have that bit of conflict that goes on there, because old habits don't die easily. Certainly, whether or not the leg is going to be amputated is a big issue in the beginning. But there are other issues, too, that come up in terms of who's done the right thing here, because suddenly another character shows up named John. He's a newly freed black slave, too. And while Simon wants to be nice about the situation, John is not nice about the situation at all. I mean, he has genuine hard feelings of what happened, and understandably so. He's been whipped by the Whipping Man. And there are tremendous stories that I won't give away about what happened when you went to the Whipping Man, and certainly how Caleb reacted when he saw the slaves whipped. And it's so the first act, I think, is tremendously interesting and engrossing. I think it's almost perfect. Every line of dialogue kept me fascinated. And then the second act happened. And I have to say that the second act didn't interest me nearly as much. There were secrets that were revealed. One secret actually comes at the end of the first act, and secrets that do get revealed. But it almost seemed to me as if the playwright Matthew Lopez took a course where they said, you must give every character a secret and you must reveal it eventually. Because it almost seemed pro forma the way it was happening. So the first act to me, while engrossing, was so, so tight, so, so dramatic, that I was very disappointed that the second act never hit me that way. I will say that there is a tremendously interesting situation involving the slaves' religion. One doesn't expect black slaves to be in the Jewish religion, but if your masters were Jews, well, that's what happened. So that's an interesting facet of this play, too. I liked that very much, because who expects that? There's also a date that's mentioned in the first act, that if you know history, you'll put two and two together. If you don't, there's going to be a bit of a surprise. But all in all, how I wish that the second act could have been up to the first act, because I think we would have had truly, I mean this, a great play.
All right. Michael, what'd you think about it?
Well, first of all, full disclosure, I'm a pretty good friends with Jay Wilkerson, who plays the soldier, Caleb. So for whatever that's worth. But I thought the acting from everyone involved, all three men, was superb. I think, to me, this is another one of those cases where the acting really elevates the material, which, although a lot of it was fascinating, I didn't really think it worked that well overall. To me, you know, if you're going to do a play where you were presented with Jewish Southerners and their Jewish slaves, that in itself is so interesting and unique that that should be kind of the primary point of the play. Whereas to me here, it was just some other thing and kind of thrown in, and I almost take it for granted. And it's such a disconnect to hear these slaves, you know, saying prayers in Hebrew and you know, observing a Seder and things like that, that to me, that it should have been a whole separate piece, because there was so much else going on. It's about the end of the war. And I mean, I will admit there's a nice kind of correspondence between the fact that apparently the Civil War ended just at Passover, which, and of course, that's a really neat comparison with the Hebrew slaves becoming free and the black slaves becoming free. But I don't know, it just seems so strange to see them. And of course, we know from the plays of Alfred Urey that something about Jewish Southerners, which is something that maybe a lot of us didn't know about before. But to have the slaves adopt the Jewish religion, and I just thought it should have been treated on its own rather than all this other stuff. And also, yeah, I'm sorry. some of the revelations, especially the last one I did not see coming, but I just thought that was a kind of a cheapo one. The first revelation I saw coming from like the first 2 minutes of the play. So I don't think it was entirely successful in terms of structure and dramaturgy. But the acting was amazing. And we have to mention, this play has a set by John Lee Beatty that is one of the best sets I've ever seen for any show in my entire life. And the lighting, although very dim, is also incredibly, incredibly good. You have got to see this play if only for the set. You know, and on top of that, you'll get great acting and some really good writing too. So,
Michael, yeah. May I interrupt to say, while I was walking out of the theater, and I was on the extreme right side, while I was walking out, that gave me a chance to look at the set in its entirety close up. And I don't know if you noticed, but behind what we see, there are the rooms, and they were decorated as well. So the attention to detail was pretty amazing. It often amazes me what detail people put in sets. A couple of years ago, when I was hosting the Theater World Awards, we were at the Friedman Theater, where Accent on Youth was playing. So as a result, I was on the stage, and there was a bookcase filled with books. And what I learned was that each one of those books was imprinted with the name of the author that David Hyde Pierce was playing. They actually went to that detail by putting his name on each of the books. Each one was one of his books. And while I was off stage, I also saw the room that leads out to the back wall of the theater. And yet, there was such a tremendous detail of appointments. The little table was perfectly in keeping with the rest of the room. And what was on the table, the knickknacks, were all perfectly in period. And believe me, even if you were in row AAA, you would not be able to see these. And yet, just in case somebody could, that somebody has 20/10 vision, that the detail is really that fine. And that was true of this set as well. Yes, I'm very, very remiss in not having mentioned Ben Stanton's lighting, which was amazing beyond belief. But John Lee Beatty, who is a big hero of mine, and the rabbit hole set he designed, which twisted and turned. He solved the problem of a house with different rooms so wonderfully. So yes, I'm ashamed of myself for not mentioning those things or the acting, because yes, it was quite fine.
Yeah, I agree with everything that Michael and Peter just said, especially set. We haven't said exactly what it is. It's a big Southern mansion that looks like it's been bombed and looted as part of the Civil War. So it's basically the remnants of it. And yeah, it's really amazing. The one thing that they're really really struck me is there's a big hole in the ceiling and the light comes down through that. So the entire house is really dark except for this one patch where there's bright sunlight coming through. So it really is amazing from that standpoint. I just wanted to expand on one thing, on two things that Michael and Peter both said. First of all, yeah, the acting overall is pretty good. I was amazed by Andre Brower, though. I thought he was just absolutely spectacular as the older of the two slaves and the one who has a wife and children, who aren't there presently, and who really kind of goes through the toughest stuff aside from the whole leg thing. But he was great. I haven't seen him on stage a lot, if any, before, but he's an incredibly natural and powerful stage actor. So if all you know him from is television, then really I don't think you're seeing the full depth of his talent here. But the other thing I wanted to say about Peter's comment about the second act, I agree that the second act is not as good as the first act, especially the first scene, which features Caleb reading a letter that he wrote to this girl that he was involved with. And then they did one of those things I hate, where immediately after that little kind of in one scene, they go back and then they start talking about the letter, and then one of the characters repeats the entire thing that we just heard. And to me, that's a huge waste of stage time, and they could cut that and save 5 minutes off the show and not lose any vital information. And that's one of my own little personal pet peeves. But another pet peeve that I have that I've talked about before is playwrights writing plays of the length that is going to match the depth and complexity of the show that they're doing. This is a play, Peter and Michael have both alluded to this, that this is a play that is really complex and that has a lot of things going on. Michael said that he thought that they should have done something a little bit more special with such a really unusual idea as black Jewish people in the South during the Civil War. I agree with that, but I think that there just isn't enough time in a traditional two-act structure of a play like this. My personal feeling is that the problem with the second act wasn't that there was anything wrong with the way it was written, but that it was setting up a third act that the playwright didn't write. The very end of the second act involves the two characters who are most at odds with each other throughout the entire thing and who are constantly yelling and bickering and challenging each other about a million different things, left alone together in the house, just sitting there staring at each other. And I thought, okay, in a play in the 20s or 30s, they'd turn down the lights, and then in 15 minutes they'd come back up, and then the family would come back, and then they'd have all this all out, and we would see how all of this plays out in the real world. But no, the playwright leaves it hanging there, and the play isn't well enough written or vividly enough constructed to make you care enough about imagining what's going to happen to them after. I thought that Matthew Lopez was completely setting things up for more of a story to be told, but then he didn't tell it, and he's kind of leaving that up to the audience. I think that there is a virtue to that in some circumstance, but I think that what's there is too weak to really support that the way it's done. Unlike Michael, I really did like a lot of the Jewish black stuff. There's a very lengthy Seder scene where they hold their Passover dinner, and they're kind of a makeshift Passover dinner with hardtack and other things that they can just find lying around. And I thought that was actually a very clever use of the theme, but again, it's really the only time that they do anything like that, and the rest of the time it's a very conventional play. There's a lot of good stuff in it. I just really wanted more from it in terms of the play itself and the details that were there. So if he ever writes a third act, I would totally go back, because there's enough there to support it, I think.
Matthew, again, just to clarify, it's not so much that I didn't like the Jewish stuff. I just thought that it was so unusual that it needed to be treated more in depth rather than just sort of something that was taken for granted and presented almost in passing.
I understand that, Michael. I didn't see the Seder scene as being in passing, though. I saw that as really kind of an integral part of the show.
But oh, no.
Other than that, I agree with you.
Yeah, no, I mean, I guess I see what you're saying. I just meant that the whole fact that they were Jewish to begin with and how they became Jewish and, you know, how that related to their, you know, their relations to everyone else in the area, other slaves, other, you know, other white people. To me, that's so interesting, you know, because it's so unusual. And I just personally, I thought that it could have been its own play rather than a play that's not primarily about that.
There's something to be said for that. I agree with that entirely. But I like the matter-of-fact way that the slaves were doing the Seder, because indeed, that's the way they were brought up. But I do think that Michael has a very good point when he talks about the relationship to the other people in town. So it sounds like we're making a big 3-hour movie out of this, though.
I wanted to know, I am sorry if you guys had mentioned it and I missed it. Have you seen anything else by Matthew Lopez, the playwright?
I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't think so either.
Oh, by the way, I think we failed to mention the third actor in the cast was Andre Holland, who plays John. We don't want to not mention him because he was terrific too.
Yes, he was.
Yeah.
Michael, had you seen anything else by Matthew Lopez?
No, not that I know of.
So I'm looking at his webpage, and he has 4 plays listed on his webpage. One called Reverberation. A second one called Tio Pepe, The Whipping Man is the third one, and the fourth one is Zoe's Perfect Wedding. And he's got a couple of lines from each of the scripts that sum it up. And on The Whipping Man, he says, war is not proof of God's absence, it's of his absence from men's hearts. Do you find that that's the crux of the play, or?
I would not say so personally, but it's a very nice line. That's a very well-written line.
It is a good line. I'm not sure I believe it, but it's a good line.
Okay. Excellent. All right. So we'll link to Matthew Lopez's website in the show notes if you want to go take a look at it for yourself. It's interesting. I'm just assuming from his name that he is not Jewish, but he could be.
Sure.
You know, we took a... Does anybody know if Alfred Uri is Jewish? I think he is. I'm not sure.
Oh, I guess I just assumed because he's written several plays about it, but
yeah.
I don't know
yeah.
for sure. There was just recently an interview with Matthew Lopez. I cannot remember where it was, but in one of the major theater outlets. So if someone wants to Google, I'm sure they can find that.
Next thing we have up here is Road to Qatar. Matthew, why don't you start us off with that?
Well, The Road to Qatar has at its core what must be one of the most weirdly, unbelievably, ridiculously true stories that the musical theater has ever dared to tackle. And that's that the two writers of the show, Stephen Cole and David Crane, were asked, and again, I want to stress, this really happened, in 2005 to write a musical for the Emir of Qatar to celebrate the opening of a new stadium over there. They were flown to the Middle East to write the show and to meet the various people and learn all of the things that they had to include. It had to be about the Sultan's son who can't leave the palace. It had to include the Persian Gulf somehow. It had to include this. It had to include that other thing. And so they were writing a musical on commission, supposedly for a very large amount of money that theater people don't always see. And so obviously a lot of bizarre things happened, and they wrote this show called Aspire to celebrate the opening of the stadium. And you would think, wouldn't you, that there would be enormous theatrical potential there, and there might be. But in the musical The Road to Qatar at the York Theatre Company, which is about this, you see none of it. It really is like a fifth-rate producer's knockoff without any of the wit or the cleverness or, to be honest, a lot of the good songs. The only song in The Road to Qatar that I liked was the title song from the show that they wrote in the Middle East called Aspire. And I mean, that was a great song. That was something where literally after hearing it once, I was walking around for 3 or 4 days afterwards with the chorus stuck in my head because it was just that catchy. And I loved it from that standpoint. And then it introduced me to this wonderful title song. And also before the show, if you've ever gone to the York Theater, you know, Jim Morgan makes a speech in front of before every show talking about the history of it and various other things that are going on. And he said before this show that everyone should go to YouTube and look up a video called The Road to Qatar that was sort of a mini documentary that explained all this. And I, to be honest, I hate saying this, I would highly recommend that people do that instead of buying a ticket to go see The Road to Qatar, because you get a much better idea of what the show itself actually was. The two guys come across as much more personable and human in real life than they do on stage, as played by James Beeman and Keith Gerchak, who sing very well. Everyone sings very well, but the show is so false and so plastic and so bleeding technicolor and so fake and so unbelievable that really it makes you just think that there's no possible way this could ever have happened. And really, that's the opposite of what the show should do. It should prove to you that this unbelievable thing actually could and did occur. And the show doesn't do that. It's 90 minutes long. It feels way longer than that. And I appreciate the fact that they would write such an unusual musical, but I really wish it had been more entertaining, because this is a really low point for the season for me. But the road to Qatar on YouTube is definitely worth watching. 20 minutes long. Check it out.
It's actually broken up into two videos, and we'll post both of them on the show page. All right, Michael, so what did you think of Road to Qatar?
Qatar, yeah. Road to Qatar. I guess there's no point in beating a dead horse, as it were. The show got some of the worst reviews in history, sorry to say. I think worse.
Wait, Michael, can you say that the same week as Spider-Man?
I was about to make that point, yeah. And a lot of people seem to be offended by it. You know, there's always that very slippery slope of when ethnic stereotypes are presented on stage, especially when they're not written and or acted by people who are actually of that ethnicity. So I guess I shouldn't have been surprised at how incredibly offended some people were, as critics and audience members, by the portrayal of the Arabs in this musical.
Michael, I'm sorry. I just want to interrupt really quick. You know, part of the problem I had with the show, I wasn't offended by it, by anything except on behalf of the theater, because the jokes were so lame. Now, I don't know Stephen Cole or David Crane in person, but if the show is accurate, I'm assuming that they're both gay and they're both Jewish. But the gay and the Jewish jokes in the show were so pathetic and unfunny that I didn't see them as any better or, frankly, any worse than the Arab jokes they had. It was just a lot of Z-caliber writing that was like what people do when they're trying to be funny but don't really know how to do it.
I completely agree, but what I'm saying is that my old thing about it, you can be incredibly offensive if you're also very funny, as South Park has proven countless times. But in this case, they weren't that funny, so it just gave you more room to be offended. But you know what? This is interesting to me. This brings up a point, I think, to consider in terms of the Book of Mormon, because with South Park, for example, there's the argument that one of the reasons they're able to get away with some of that incredibly vile, offensive humor is precisely because it's a cartoon. It's literally an animated cartoon. And it can be very different to do the same kind of jokes with live people. So that's something I hadn't actually specifically thought of in terms of Book of Mormon. And I guess we're going to see if that's going to be an issue. There have been some shows, like The Producers comes immediately to mind, that had really kind of potentially offensive things against gays and other minorities, but that one was so broad and almost a cartoon, even though it had live people in it. So it's always fascinating to see the balance that's required to make potentially offensive humor funny rather than just offensive.
Well, this brings up a good point too, because you mentioned The Producers and you mentioned Book of Mormon, and both of these shows have a pedigree attached to them. Everybody knows when they're going in, because these people have a history, Mel Brooks and the South Park people. Certainly you go in, you have that awareness. With Stephen Cole and David Crane, you don't, because you don't know who they are. So there is a strange type of pass that is given. I remember so many times arguing about so many points in The Producers that I didn't like, and people said, it's Mel Brooks! case closed, QED. It's entirely possible that's going to make a difference with South Park. However, Michael, I do agree with you, and I remember when that first occurred to me, and that was years ago, decades ago, when there was a movie called Fritz the Cat, which was an animated feature. And I remember,
yes,
when I saw a cat urinating in full view on the screen, I thought, They're getting away with it because it's animation. And therefore, I mean, if you saw a person doing this, you'd certainly have a different feeling about it. So yes, you're right about that. The animation does help things. And this may very well be a problem for the Book of Mormon, because there ain't going to be no animation up there. Well, there may be, but I mean, certainly the main event will certainly be real human beings. So we shall see what we shall see.
I wanted to bring up one point here about the Road to Qatar is that they did write this musical for the opening of a stadium. And this stadium is actually going to be the crown jewel of the 2022 World Cup, which in the United States is known as soccer and in the rest of the world is known as football. So this is going to be the focus of it. And who knows if they have until 2022 to keep rewriting this thing and making it better.
One more positive note, just to agree with what Matthew said, that the song Aspire, which is from the actual show, is so far superior to anything else in it that it's almost like a different team wrote it. You sit there and you think, well, how could this be the same people? I don't know, maybe they had more time to spend writing the original than writing the musical about the musical, but it's so catchy and it's a great song. And I think that song will have a future life because it's just too good.
I know, and we've talked about this before about other shows and other productions, but it seems to me that I've been hearing about The Road to Qatar for many, many years. Is that your experience too?
Well, James, you couldn't have heard about it before 2005.
Right,
no, yeah. But that's still 6 years ago.
Well, that's true.
That's still, you know, and it leads to us sort of into a later conversation that I was planning on bringing up, which was about at one point or another, writers need to, you know, leave the project and move on. You know, we talk about Rodgers and Hammerstein putting out, you know, once a year, putting out, you know, South Pacific and then Oklahoma, then Carousel. If in fact that was the order or not, you guys could tell me better than I would know.
No, James.
I got it all wrong, didn't I?
Yeah.
You know, time.
But, we understand your point. Yeah.
Time is linear for you guys. I'm not so linear with time. And we might say this about Spider-Man too. Should they continue to work on Spider-Man? Stephen Colbert has joined the New York Philharmonic production of Company. Did you guys hear about this?
Yes.
I understand he's a big Sondheim fan.
He seemingly is a very big Sondheim fan.
He interviewed Sondheim on his show not that long ago.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, we discussed it. Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Michael, what do you think about this?
Well, I think the casting that's been listed so far, you know, sounds very good. I personally am not 100% convinced by the casting of Patti LuPone, but I guess that's just me. But everyone else they've listed, you know, I think sounds great. And it'll be interesting to see, to hear. I believe that Stephen is playing Harry, who doesn't do a lot of singing, but he does do some. We will get to hear him sing. And I think that this is going to be an unmissable concert, you know, if only to hear those original orchestrations, as I've said before, played by a world-class orchestra. So can't wait to see that. Also, James, if I could, I mentioned to Matthew before we started, I have another free entertainment item.
Yeah.
People
absolutely
might want to put on there. Gerard Alessandrini has written a musical based on Madam X, which is most famous, I think, from the Lana Turner film. This musical is actually based on the book, but it's quite similar, obviously. And on Thursday, February 24th at 2:15 in the Bruno Walter Auditorium of the Lincoln Center Library, there will be a free open to the public reading of the musical with Donna English in the title role as Madam X, Roxy Lucas as Evelyn Henderson. She's a Forbidden Broadway alum. Edward Stoudemire, another Forbidden Broadway alum, is also going to be in it. Bill Coyne, who's a great young talent just recently out of NYU, and Mo Rocca. He is going to be in it too. They're not sure which role he's going to play. So that sounds to me like that might definitely be worth it, attending for free at the Bruno Walter Auditorium on Thursday.
This is also interesting from the vantage point that since Forbidden Broadway closed, obviously Gerard's been busy, because I also understand he has a musical that deals with the Nutcracker Ballet. Do you know about that, Michael?
Yeah, he just did two readings of that, and he also has a musical of Moon Over Parador that he's been working on with Paul Mazursky, who did the original film, I believe. So, yeah, he's quite busy.
That's only
one of his projects that you might want to check out.
Wow, that's great information. Thanks for bringing it to us.
Sure.
We have to, as we get closer, remind us again so that way people... they don't forget about it. We miss it.
Sure. Next
week. I'm very disappointed that I didn't follow my own advice and get tickets to the company concert because it's more or less sold out right now. It's very hard to get any good tickets to it right now. And Nika Nani Rose, Martha Plimpton.
Right. Yeah. Nika Nani Rose as Marta, I believe. Right.
Yes.
Who's the one who sings Another 100 People?
Jim Walton.
Yes, Jim Walton. Yeah, a Sondheim alum. You know, it's interesting that Another 100 People, that role of Marta has in at least one previous production, and now this one has been played by a black woman. And the reason that's interesting is that one of the lines that the character has to Robert is, she says to him, "How many black people do you know? How many Jews?" She's kind of implying that his world is maybe a little too insular, and you know, he should get out more. And so it takes on a different meaning if the character who's saying it is actually African American.
Yeah. Oh, this is interesting. It's going to be conducted by Paul Gemignani and orchestrations by Jonathan Tunick.
Yeah, it's the originals. Yeah.
I'm kidding. It's Sondheim. Who else conducts and orchestrates it?
Well, you know, as I think I mentioned a few weeks ago, that the Philharmonic was going to do Company 2 or 3 years ago, and then it was delayed because of the John Doyle revival. So I really am very happy that they rescheduled it. It's going to be a joy to hear those orchestrations again.
Yeah. Do we know what instrument Neil Patrick Harris is playing? Has that been announced?
He's got the tambourine.
Yeah.
I just to make it complete, Neil Patrick Harris is playing Bobby, but you know, pretty much we can assume everybody knows that. But just to be complete, we should say that. Peter, you got an opportunity to see the Catch Me If You Can press peek. Do you want to tell us anything about it? I saw some videos on Broadway.com about it.
It's funny when you just mentioned Paul Gemignani, that of course he would be involved with the Sondheim show. I was harkened back to how he started his association with Sondheim, and he was a very lucky man because the usual musical director for Sondheim show was a man named Harold Hastings. And Harold Hastings got involved with a new musical and decided to be a co-producer of it. And since he was a co-producer, he obviously had to do the show, become its musical director. So he left Follies to do this new show called The Selling of the President. This was in 1972. And as a result, his assistant, Paul Gemignani, had to take over Follies. So that's what really spurred that career. If indeed Hal Hastings hadn't been involved with The Selling of the President, Paul Gemignani might not have had the career and the association he had. So the ill wind line comes into play here. Why do I mention The Selling of the President at all? Because this show that lasted 5 performances had a book and some lyrics, I believe, by Jack O'Brien. So it's funny to see Jack O'Brien at a press preview now with many, many Tony Awards, both for musicals and for plays, having this astonishing career, directing this musical about Frank Abagnale Jr., a con man who has since received a second chance. Both of these guys have received second chance. Sure. Okay. There's a profound difference between a man who pretends to be a pilot and flies airplanes and a man who's had a flop Broadway show. But nevertheless, it was interesting to me to see both Jack O'Brien and the real Frank Abagnale on stage in the rehearsal hall of the Duke on 42nd Street. And it was so interesting, too, to see Frank Abagnale Jr. seem so sheepish about what he had done. He really established the fact that he'd gone straight. He talked about being a grandfather. He talked about the fact that people are more interested in that part of my life, but I'm more impressed with this part of my life. And it was really something. And it almost was kind of dour to start off a big, splashy musical with this. But once we got into the real show itself, everybody had quite a wonderful time. This is a show that is much of the Hairspray people all over again. Composer and co-lyricist Mark Shaman, co-lyricist Scott Whitman, Jack O'Brien, as we said, choreographer Jerry Mitchell, cast members Linda Hart and Carrie Butler in it as well. So it's sometimes these things work out. You know, sometimes the pajama game led to Damn Yankees. Sometimes they don't work out. The producers led to Young Frankenstein. We'll see. But nevertheless, it seems to be a terrifically entertaining show for the tired businessman and tired businesswoman. For one thing, Aaron, how is his last name pronounced, Matthew?
Tveit, I think.
Is that right? I wouldn't
believe so.
Well, we're all going to know how it's pronounced, because he's going to get a tremendous amount of attention because he is terrific in the lead role playing Frank. And we wouldn't necessarily assume this from Next to Normal. Well, he had to play the grown-up son and in a very serious musical. Here, he's a terrific song and dance man with amazing charisma. So he really brought the first number, not that the first number needed an infusion of life, because it's a really big and important production number, but he is the centerpiece of it, and he's tremendous in it. It's called Live in Living Color, and here's why. What they've decided to do is start the show with a chase, and Frank is captured. And at that point, his whole life flashes before his eyes. And he thinks of it as a 60s TV variety show special. Now, I think this is wise, and I'll tell you why. When Bob Fosse was doing Chicago, he must have known somewhere along the way that if indeed he put Roxy Hart in a realistic musical, that indeed people would rail against it because you couldn't get behind what, well, as Billy Flynn calls her, a Cobbin criminal. Yeah, so, but doing it as a vaudeville puts it on a completely different level. J. Pierpont Finch, we talked about animation earlier, but How to Succeed is pretty much a cartoon. Now, in the same era of How to Succeed, we also had I Can Get a Few Wholesale and What Makes Sammy Run, two shows about anti-heroes, guys who cheat, guys who are not on the level, and they were played realistically. And as a result, they didn't run nearly as long, even put together, as How to Succeed in Business. So I think the idea of using a TV variety show format was very smart, so that we don't have to really ask ourselves too many questions about the unethical thing these guys are doing. So I think that's kind of nice. So Norbert Leo Butz is in it, too, and he has we saw a terrific production number from him, too, which is so exhausting that he pretended at the end of the number to fall on the floor and crawl off the stage. He wasn't that tired, but his point was well taken. There's a nice country waltz that Carrie Butler sings called Fly, Fly Away. She's Frank's girlfriend, and she wants him to get away with it, even though she knows he's done the wrong things. Tom Wopat's in it, too, playing Frank's father, Senior. And they have a nice song of different opinions about life, how they view life. And it's a song that's very reminiscent of, parentheses, your timeless to me. You do hear echoes of the Hairspray score. There's no question that Mark Shaman has a distinctive sound, and you'll hear it. So a lot of it does sound like Hairspray, and I don't mean that in the worst sense of the word. I just mean that, again, just as one can tell that so many times the writer of one song is the writer of another, you'll be able to do that here too. But this looks pretty much like it's going to be a big audience pleaser. So don't be surprised if the Hairspray team winds up being on the stage of, is it the Beacon Theater? Is that where the Tonys are going to be? Is that what we decided?
Yes, the Beacon.
Come June. So so good luck to it.
I didn't see the press preview that Peter did, but I have, of course, seen the movie and the book that the movie was based on. I've read, and they're very entertaining. So I think that the musical certainly has a good chance of being a lot of fun. So it should be interesting to see. And of course, Aaron Tveit and Norbert Leo Butz and Tom Wopat, and Carrie Butler are all very talented performers. So they're and it seems like they are making a lot of good choices so far.
Yeah, I think so.
I think this is going to be a really really great spring season. I see a lot of stuff on the horizon coming in, and it's very exciting. Linda Weiner over at Newsday just wrote a story about. You know, we had proclaimed the end of Broadway with all the closings in the winter, but we have a lot of stuff coming in, and it could be very exciting. I'm looking forward to it. We did have a special short episode of This Week on Broadway in the middle of the week when Michael Riedel from the New York Post joined us and we talked about Spider-Man. Any further thoughts? Peter wasn't able to join us for that. Peter, you have any thoughts about the all these reviews coming out about Spider-Man?
Not a thing. Spider-Man is something I don't think about very much, I have to admit. It's going to be astonishing for me when I finally show up at that theater and see the show that, wow, after all this time and after all this ink and electronic ink, so to speak, I'm not really going to believe that it's really going to happen until I actually sit there. And when yesterday on the news it turned out that they were cited for two violations, I mean, whenever I hear the word Spider-Man in the news, I'm half anticipating that I'm going to hear the producers decide to close it, and that I will have missed it, which I have mixed feelings about if I wind up missing it. I can't imagine what I could possibly say that hasn't been said before. I have many of the feelings and emotions that everybody else has, and I don't feel even remotely interested in going into them. So we'll see what happens in terms of. I just wonder if they're even going to come March 15th. If they're even going to say to critics, okay, now you can come. They might like this idea that critics have to buy tickets. You know, we're adding to the box office still, that way. So,
Matthew, anything new?
I don't have anything new that I can really say on the air compared to what I said the other day. I don't think the story about Spider-Man is finished being written yet. And, you know, I will just say one thing in response to something Peter said. I was at the public theater the other day to see Compulsion, the show with Mandy Patinkin about Meyer Levin that Peter saw and talked about, I guess, at the Yale Rep a while back. And there were a number of other critics there who had not, as I had not, reviewed Spider-Man. And we were all talking about whether they would invite us back. And I really do think that they will. I think that they will at least go through the motions of you know, the official opening, and whether or not they give those of us who didn't write about it before better seats. I would certainly hope so, but I don't think that they're gonna like turn away the New York Times and say, oh, you can't come review this. I don't think that's gonna happen. So I think that they will be invited, whether many of them write new pieces might depend on how many changes are made between now and March. Whatever, 7th, 8th, whenever they quote-unquote freeze it. So, I think that there are a lot of possibilities, but I have a feeling that saying to the New York Times and the New York Post and the New York Daily News, no, you can't come, I don't think that's going to happen. We'll see, but I just have a feeling.
What do you guys think about these focus groups that they're holding?
I'm surprised. If they're going to do that, I think they should have done that earlier.
I would say, Peter, please forgive me if I'm misinterpreting what you're saying, but I hear what Peter's saying is it's too late for it to do any good. And I think I would probably agree with that, actually. Unless they're really willing to hunker down for the next 3 or 4 weeks, I don't see how the focus groups at this point are going to make a difference.
I was reminded about, we touched on this just briefly before, and the first show that we talked about being a Guare show. Another Guare show called 6 Degrees of Separation. And I don't know if either one of you recalls the scene when Flan talks about how the children's art is so beautiful. And he goes to the art teacher and he says, how come these kids are so talented? And she says, I know when to take it away from them. And
That's a good line.
I sort of feel like that's, you know, many, many Broadway shows need to be taken away from the creators to either fly out of the nest or fall and die. And I think that that's the point we're at with Spider-Man. It's it. You know, they had all the opportunity in the world, but it, you know, there's so many things in life that look great on paper that just won't fly. So
literally in this case, sometimes.
that's a good point. Maybe that's why it was stuck in my head. So let's wrap up here by acknowledging that tomorrow is Valentine's Day. What are our favorite Valentine's musicals or Valentine's songs? Peter, What should we be doing for our loved ones?
I'm reminded, I was asked a few years ago by Broadway World about this, and they asked for the most romantic song. And what first came to mind to me was Blame It on the Summer Night from Rags. And Michael Dale, the columnist for that site, wrote me and said, romantic? Gee, I think that was as a sexy song, not a romantic song. And I said, well, there I am. I never could tell the difference between love and sex. What can I tell you? But of course, what obviously comes to mind is My Funny Valentine, which a lot of people think has to do with Valentine's Day because the end of the lyric deals with that. But My Funny Valentine comes from Babes in Arms, where there's a character named Valentine. So as a result, when she's singing that song, that's what she means. So that's the obvious one. I think perhaps the most romantic song I can think of at the moment, what immediately comes to mind, because I didn't know this question was coming, was You Have Made Me Love, from the musical Cyrano from the early 70s. Lee Berry sang it about Christiane, though Cyrano wishes that indeed, she was singing it to him. A composer named Michael Lewis, who died a few years ago, only did one Broadway show. Very famous for doing a lot of movie scores, but only did one Broadway show. I would recommend people get a hold of the Cyrano album, which I think is one of the best overtures ever, and has a lot of very pretty music in it. When when it was recorded, strangely enough, it wasn't recorded in its entirety, but it was released on two records, and much, not all, but much of the dialogue was included. So it's a long listen, frankly, but it's a wonderful one. And just to hear You Have Made Me Love, I think is something worth hearing.
And that's just to confirm with our listeners that that had nothing to do with that 90s revival from Juven End. Yeah.
Right. It's okay. Not the Dutch one. It's Christopher Plummer won a Tony for it. So, it's has a lot of nice stuff in it. Doing a Cyrano de Bergerac musical is a tough thing to do. And I won't say that they totally succeeded, but there is a lot of nice music in it.
All right. Matthew, anything to add that you, any favorite songs of yours?
Well, there are certainly a lot of great love songs out there. I, you know, have a particular fondness for Rodgers and Hart in that area. And certainly Cole Porter wrote some very good ones as well. But I gotta give a shout out to the underdog here, just for my own personal preference and biases. I would say that The Next Best Thing to Love by Man, which everyone either knows or should know from a class act, but was originally written for Scandal, which was the Michael Bennett project that never ended up happening. That's an absolutely wonderful song about modern, unconventional relationships and the things that go right and even more frequently wrong with them. So that would certainly be my choice. But that Cyrano song that Peter mentioned is certainly wonderful. And it's kind of weird that there aren't more Valentine's Day songs. Certainly, My Funny Valentine is one of the classics, but if not the classic of all of them. But yeah, there are a lot of good ones out there. But I'm going to go with the Klee Band this time.
Well, Matthew, I adore that song. And every year when I give out my own personal awards, I always give a best song award. And that was when I heard that song at the Manhattan Theater Club, even before it moved to Broadway. That was my song of the year. And my admiration for that song is second to none, even to you. However, sorry. Well, there should be a meter to be able to determine this. However, to be fair, it's not really a true love song in the quintessential sense, in that it really deals more with friendship than with lovers, though it does indicate, of course, that the next best thing to love is love, that the love that people have as friendship is damn close, if not equal to the real thing.
Peter, so, I completely agree with you and I understand, but this is one of those cases where I think that the music and the lyrics work at odds with each other to very good effect. I think that the music is saying one thing, the lyrics are saying something else, which leads you to infer certain things about the character who's singing it that perhaps even the character herself or himself would not admit. But you're certainly right that going strictly by the lyrics, it says one thing. But to me, it counts as a love song, no matter what. I mean, I like a lot of Bobby Van love songs, including I Choose You, which is heard in a very, very fragmented version in a class act. And he wrote some other very nice ones as well. But I always look to him first for this kind of thing. And I think that the next best thing to love is whether it's a love song or a like song or any other kind of song, it's worth listening to on Valentine's Day.
Any day of the year, morning, noon, and afternoon, and night.
All right, I'll just throw in my quick two cents here that I chose Right from Baby is one of my favorite love songs.
Nice song.
Yeah. All righty. So let's wrap up here. I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayStars.com. And on the right-hand side, there's a Broadway Radio logo. There should be, at one point or another, a subscribe button there. And that way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded and you won't miss anything. You can also subscribe in the Zune Marketplace. You can also listen to us through Stitcher Radio or Google's Listen application, or listen to us on Broadway World Radio on Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. If you want to contact us to let us know if you agree, disagree, or just fill us in on some information, there's all sorts of contact information on the show page where you can reach each one of us, or go to the front page of BroadwayStars.com, and on the upper right-hand corner, there's a contact form. Send us an email. You can also give us a call. Leave a voicemail at 646-873-7695, and if you do leave a voicemail, we may play it on the podcast. So on behalf of Michael Portantier, Peter Felicia, and Matthew Murray, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye, all.
Bye.
Bye, everybody.